Hello, everybody. Today we start with our second double lecture on screening the East German dictatorship. Let's start with a short look back on the last two sessions 2 weeks ago, which were dedicated to the beginning, to the earlier decades of the East German dictatorship and its film industry. We have talked about the establishment of the East German dictatorship and the reconstruction of cinema production in East Germany under the monopoly of a new state enterprise, the Deutsche Film Aktiengesellschaft DEFA, the main producer of all films in the GDR. Feature films, documentary, whatsoever. And I had introduced you into the dilemma and the problems of this film industry in the early years of the communist dictatorship, which was marked by a rush and very brutal implementation of communist rule, including a tight censorship on film production, and including a very dogmatic and narrow-minded doctrine of how socialist films should be, the so-called dogma of socialist realism, which was prevailing from the late 40s onwards, from 59 onwards, when the GDR was founded, and when Germany in general was divided up in two countries, one pertaining to the liberal West with a much more liberal film industry, and another eastern part of Germany, which had become the GDR, where you would have film production under the tight control of the Communist Party, including the obligation to further the construction of communist rule by filmmaking in very dogmatic and propagandistic way. This was where also early years of relatively low artistic productivity, one can say, and I introduced you in the first wave of, let's say, more creative filmmaking, which came about, as in most other East European countries, after the death of Stalin. Think of the so-called thaw in the Soviet Union, which prompted a new generation of films, the so-called thaw films. And we have a similar phenomenon in East Germany, and I introduced you to one category of these new films, the films oriented by or influenced by Italian neorealism, which engaged very critically with the conditions under which East Germans had to live. I showed you the example of the so-called Berlin films by Gerhard Klein and Wolfgang Kohlhase as, let's say, typical for these early, more critical engagements with reality in East Berlin under the impact of the German division and of the conflict between the two systems. Now, this narrative I gave you last time ended almost in 57, 58, when the film we had seen, Berlin Ecke Schönhauser, about the young rock and rollers in East Berlin and their conflicts with the grown-ups, was, after it had quite some success particularly with the young audience, it was heavily criticized by the party and then forbidden and banned and would not be shown again in the GDR until the end of the GDR. This was in 58, when, so to speak, the more dogmatic parts of the party took over again and the liberal phase was finished. And this is where we restart our account. I will, in these two lectures this week, cover, first of all, in the term of more general introduction to the GDR history, the development until the end of the 60s. And I will cover with that together the next, so to speak, thaw phase, the next phase of liberalization, which was basically in the first half of the 60s after the construction of the wall. So this is, one can say, this period after 58 can be subsumed under the motto that now the East German leadership and after the first attempts of liberalization somehow had been stalled, tried to another second attempt to transform East German society completely into a socialist one. Within 1.5 years after the suppression of the Hungarian Revolution, we see such a return to a harsh course. And let's take a look at, at our timeline. A crucial event in this tendency is the so-called Fifth Party Congress of the Socialist Unity Party, the SED. The SED now declares a economic main task, which consists of reaching and passing West Germany in per capita consumption within the next 7 years. This was a very bold claim because West Germany was well advanced in terms of affluence and in terms of accessibility of consumer good. You might have heard of the notion of the so-called Wirtschaftswunder, the miracle, the economic miracle taking place in West Germany in the 50s. And East Germany was always lagging behind. So this was a bold claim to be made. The General Secretary of the SED, Walter Ulbricht, declared, I quote, "The national economy of the GDR has to be developed within a few years in such a way that the superiority of the socialist societal order in comparison to the rule of the imperialist forces in the Bonn state, Bonn being the capital of West Germany, can be proven beyond any doubt, and that in consequence the consumption per capita of our working population will be, with all important foods and consumer goods, will reach and surpass the consumption per capita of the all overall population in West Germany." But this was not the only decision being taken at this party congress, which then heavily influenced all economic planning and the whole policy of industry. At the same time, the party tried to impose also some kind of mental reform, a mobilization of the minds and of the spirits. And there was a lot of criticism about too much, so to speak, a too bourgeois and Western style orientation of the citizens in the GDR, and the party claimed that this also should be changed, that there should be a new moral installed. Interestingly enough, Walter Ulbricht proclaimed 10 commandments of socialist morality and ethics, something which the party up to that time had not dared to do. I just quote some of them. It sounds a bit odd and old style, but it was really handed out and published that way. "Thou shalt always commit yourself to the international solidarity of the working class and all working people and for the steadfast bonds between all socialist countries. Thou shalt love your fatherland and be always prepared to use all your strengths and capacities for the defense of the worker and peasant state." And so on and so forth. "Thou shalt abolish the expropriation of men by men, and you have to perform good deeds for socialism, to cooperate in the spirit of comradeship, to respect the people's property, always keep confirm socialist discipline, you have to educate your children in the spirit of peace and socialism." And something particularly nice, "Thou shalt live decently and properly and respect your family." So it was against all bad manners one can conceive of and was declared as a new way to construct socialism. This was important insofar as it was a kind of claiming that now with this big economic jump one wanted to make in order to bypass the Federal Republic, West Germany, there should also be a moral revolution, or as it was also expressed, a cultural revolution. It was, the term was used very often in these days, cultural revolution, kind of propagate a socialist spirit. In parallel, there were the most significant, so to speak, structural change going on in society was the forced collectivization of the agriculture. Up to that point, only 20 to 25% of agriculture had been already collectivized. Now the rest was to be collectivized by the course of repressive measure, very harsh campaigning. And so one can say in these years after 58, you would have two main directions in which the state and the party try to push society around, try to transform it into a socialist one. The, so to speak, establishing itself on the countryside as the leading force, and kind of repressing ideological influences of the West, and this were particular at this time still Christian influences. They were considered as being dominated and being manipulated by the West. What I told you, these Ten Commandments, of course, recall very much, resemble very much the Decalogue of the Christian faith. And so there were new schemes being set up in order to replace the Christian holidays. We see here something which certainly also existed in the communist Czechoslovakia, the youth consecration, a specific ritual to be introduced to replace the Christian rituals at the age of growing up of young people. So the communist state and the party try to reduce the influences of the churches by introducing such new secular rituals for wedding, baptizing, funeral. And at the same time, for instance, just to give you an indicator of the relevance of this, it was from that time onwards that you can firmly say that no one could make a career into higher levels of his profession, not only without joining the party, but also without leaving the church. Leaving the church was from that time on more or less required if you wanted to be successful in your profession. So this kind of I tell you this in order to give you an impression of the mental, of the spiritual atmosphere around the years 1960, which were also marked at the same time by an international crisis. The international crisis was revolving again around Berlin. Berlin was, as we have also seen last time, divided into two sectors, in the Western sector and an Eastern sector, and the Western sector was still under full command and remained so of the Western Allies, and thereby the West German economic and political system was established there. And but the border between East and West Berlin was always open. So this was a source of permanent influence of Western contacts, of Western ideas, of Western goods also, which was to be felt in East Berlin and thereby also in East Germany in general. And therefore, East German communists together with the Soviet Union thought ways how to get rid of this West Berlin in the middle, so to speak, of the GDR. One way to put this forward was on the level of international politics between the former allies of the Second World War, the victory powers. The Soviet Union claimed or demanded the abolition of this specific status of Berlin as a being occupied still by the victorious allies. And they issued an ultimatum that the Western Allies should move out of the Western sectors, give it up. Otherwise, East Berlin would make a separate peace treaty with East Germany. This was a kind of, it was not a very effective ultimatum because the East didn't have any measures to push the Western Allied out, except for going to war, which no one wanted at that time. You can say, safely say, no one wanted to die for Berlin. And so in the end, this crisis led to a intensified sense of precariousness, in particular among East Germans, and of insecurity, which triggered them to leave the country in more and more higher numbers. And one can say that the Berlin crisis culminated in the years after 1960. In 1960, the collectivization of agriculture had been completed. A lot of peasants, a lot of people on the countryside were frustrated, were desperate because they had lost their farms and their autonomy as farmers. And at the same time, the shortages and penuries in the economy and consumer goods were aggravating. And this is why we have a stark rise in refugees going to West Germany. You all know that this ended more or less in the construction of the Berlin Wall. You see here at this picture that how in the early 60s, in the early 60s the numbers are rising again just before August 13, and then you have a drop when the wall is built. And in the end, in 1989, as you all know, you have this rise again by hundreds of thousands. Overall, until 1961, between 1949 and 1961, 2.6 million East Germans left East Germany, which of course on the long run would have caused the total breakdown of all social and economic life in East Germany. And this is why the wall, so to speak, from a technical point of view, had to be built. The Soviet gave their okay for building the wall. There had been talks between the American President Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev of the Soviet Union in summer 61 that this would not lead to an international conflict. And thereby, on the 13th of August, you would have the construction of the wall, which one has to keep in mind was also accompanied by a very strong way of the East German state, of the party, to mobilize all its members, all its followers, particularly also the so-called working class militia were put on the street. It was not just a matter of constructing this wall in the middle of the city in Berlin. It was also a wave of repression now taking place against anyone who was considered as being unreliable. So we have in the wake of August 1961 a wave of repression, of a harsh and dogmatic course coming back. This also this related in particular to two aspects. Now, when this wall was built, it was always legitimized and argued for as a way to demarcate the own state from the West. The official legitimization for the wall was always this should hinder the Western class enemy from infiltrating into the East. Of course, everyone knew that it was about keeping people from running into the West, that it was against the people in their own country, but the official logic was it is a so-called anti-fascist protection wall, which sounded very cynical because there was no fascism on the other side in the West. But of course there were Western influences. And one of the way in which these influences had been felt in East Berlin was the one you could see also in the last movie, that there were quite a lot of people constantly moving back and forth between the two worlds. And there were quite some tens of thousands of people living in East Berlin and around West Berlin who made their living in West Berlin and went back home every evening to East Berlin. Now these people kind of were trapped in East Berlin, could not go to work anymore, and they were considered, for instance, as enemy of the people, which had to be re-educated, which had to be put under custody, and which, if they would not behave well and would not take resume work in a socialist enterprise, would be sent to a labor camp for some weeks or months. And similar things were done to people who had made their living by illegal trading at the border, or also students, high school students and university students who had visited a university in West Berlin. Another dimension of this campaign, and this touches also upon media history, is, well, we know from quite a lot of biographies and autobiographies that a lot of people were also, and among them not only young people like in the movie we had seen last time, but also writers, intellectuals, people taking part in the cultural life, were frustrated very much because they could not see Western cinema anymore. They had the habit to go to West Berlin to see films, and everyone would see his taste of films. The young ones would see the rock and roll films, the elder one would see the more artistic ones. And another factor which at the same time now was put into the center of the party's campaign was to ban and to campaign against watching Western television. Western television was accessible technically to all or most of all East Germans if they had the average equipment of a TV set, which was already at that time relatively far spread also in East Germany. And so there was a regular campaigning against reorientating the antennas on the roof, trying to forbid watching Western television and intimidating the population about this habit. People were asked at their workplace whether they would comply to this rule. Even young children, school kids, would be asked by the teacher in the next day, what is the shape of the clock in the evening news? Is it square or is it round? And if it was square, it was the East German one. If it was round, then it was the West German one. So teachers could find out what parents did at home and whether they would comply to such things. Interestingly enough, just as a side remark, watching Western TV was never formally banned. I think it was not formally banned because it was too widespread and it would have cost a lot more work really to go after all these infractions which would then have to be dealt with in court. But it was always considered as something inappropriate, which would speak against you if you would run into trouble with the party. Another aspect of this now, again, tougher course of the party state against society was something which was only possible to be introduced now, that's army conscription. Up to that point, the army had been a voluntary army, had been founded in 56 when the GDR had joined the Warsaw Pact. Now with the borders being finally closed, it made sense to at all to introduce a general duty to go to the army. And we have here one subsection which of the army which of course became particularly relevant in these years. That's the border police, which became a part of the army itself. So conscript had also, some of them had also to serve at the border and to execute this brutal border regime, similar to the one in the Iron Curtain border in Czechoslovakia, which consisted in shooting at, and if necessary, killing those who tried to overcome this border illegally. Now, on the other hand, after the war was closed, one can see a new way, a new attempt to introduce new elements of social policy, of social transformation, trying to mobilize certain segments of the population which until that point had not been reached so much. And I highlight them because they also show up in some of the films we will talk about. There is one specific group which was addressed, which is the gender question, we would say nowadays, the women. There was a famous Politburo declaration in December 1961, Die Frau, der Friede und der Sozialismus, The Woman, Peace and Socialism, which basically again laid out the official socialist or communist politics about the role of the women in building up socialism. It turned mainly around the issue of integrating women into regular employment at a very high rate, also to qualify them for higher positions, that is to let them have their share, their equal share in high school and university training. And this, of course, could be only done and be was only possible if you have enlarged infrastructure for childcare. That is childcare beginning from after, in extreme cases, 3 months after birth, so to speak. At least the crèche after from 1 year old for toddlers was regarded as a general rule. And in the long run, it was declared the aim of the regime to make sure that adult women are fully full-time employed, including the mothers of several childs, by assisting them with these childcare institutions. This entailed, among other things, that the professional advancement of women had to be furthered in all enterprises. All enterprises had to show that they would do something for this endeavor, and that they would have their special plans to enable women to take evening course classes or to be sent to the university, etc., etc. It did not play out immediately, of course, because there had already been such campaigns in the 50s. But one can say that not everywhere and in all places the directors of enterprises were kind of enthusiastic about putting resources into this kind of institutions. But with the 60s in particular, since there was always a shortage of labor and the GDR would not, for instance, introduce labor migration in order to fill up these problems, to meet these problems, the mobilization of women for work was very crucial, so that in by the 80s, or at least at the end of the 70s, the GDR was among the countries, among the industrial countries in the world, with the highest percentage of women being active in the labor market, up to 90-95% of adult women were in gainful employment, including, however, a lot of part-time practices. But the regime did as much as it caused, as it could to make this possible, which led to a paradoxical situation, insofar as for a lot of women this was accepted and greeted as a way to open up new opportunities. Nevertheless, they were left in a very traditional way with the task of taking care for the kids. It was not that the men in turn would kind of reorientate their habits and take more care than before of child care and divide up the household chores, so to speak. And this is therefore the reason why one speaks also of this very typical double burden of women in socialist countries having to take care both for the household and for work. On the other hand, it is very well known that this, of course, gave women a much higher economic independence, which then turned out to be visible in particular in the very high degrees and high rates of divorces. If women are much more on their own, they can risk less if they divorce from their husbands. So this is a typical situation, the image of the relatively independent young woman striving for professional advancement is, so to speak, a stereotype of state socialism, which emerges in these years as an ideal, as a new orientation and way of life. I tell you this because in the film you will see today such a young woman looking for her place in the new society is, so to speak, the main protagonist of the story. Starting in 1963, we can then see a begin of a reform in economy, in the sector of economy and in the sector of culture. In the economy, this meant mainly that enterprises, the nationalized enterprises, the socialist state enterprises, got much more leeway to do their own investments. They gained much more autonomy. To some extent, there was an introduction of market elements into the state-planned economy. I had already mentioned last time that in this time, in the middle of the 60s, debates about reforming the state-planned economy went very much the same way as they went, for instance, in Czechoslovakia at the time, looking out for new ways to make this very inflexible and strict system of planned economy more flexible and more adaptive. And this meant giving more autonomy to the lower levels of the economy, to the enterprises themselves, to strengthen, so to speak, responsibility of these lower units of production, and to reduce the impact of the administration and of the bureaucracy in the ministries. This together went with a atmosphere of growing liberalization also in cultural matters. One has to see that also in this way, that for a lot of intellectuals and also for a lot of party members who were not happy, so to speak, about the dictatorial and repressive character which the regime had developed again after from 58 onwards, that now the wall being closed and the risk that the GDR would simply dissolve by people running away from it, that now once had, so to speak, secured the existence of the GDR as such, one could go in a more liberal and more open way, discuss the problems of socialism more open, more directly, more honestly. This was a hope for a lot of younger adherents of the party itself, of followers of socialism who may have always kept a certain critical view of what was going on at the top level of politics, but who nevertheless supported the idea of a socialist society itself, and who now hope for a second chance, so to speak, a second chance to build up a socialist and more egalitarian and more and also anti-fascist society, which would kind of be able to compete with the Western competitor, with the Western alternative, the Federal Republic. And it is in this spirit that both the new economic system, this new economic policy was seen, as well as also other initiatives in the realm of cultural politics. Just one of it, which also ties up to what we had last time, in 1963 we have a so-called youth communique, Jugendkommuniqué of the Politburo, declaring under the title Trust and Responsibility to the Youth, which meant that finally one would accept much more openly and much more permissively, so to speak, that the youth has its own way to express itself. Interestingly enough, this was a time when beat music came up, which was accessible through airwaves also by everyone in East Germany. But at this time, in 63-64, East German radios would open up for this. Interestingly enough, the first Beatles record, which was issued in Germany, in, so to speak, by a German label, was one issued by an East German label, not by a West German one, a long play, A Hard Day's Night. So there you can see that at this point of time, one tried to offer to the youth the also the permission and the access to this kind of new culture, staging festivals and competition for beat bands, which were spreading up everywhere. And so this was also extended to the artists themselves to debate such things much more openly. I will go into the details of this regarding the field of film and in particular literary politics, because they are very much entwined in that time. But just to complete our timeline here, to go to the next step, which is that this liberal course in cultural politics very suddenly came to an end in the end of 1965. You can say with some, well, at a very vague parallel, what happened in Czechoslovakia in 68 by much more violence and with much harsher consequences. But to some extent, what happened in 68 in Czechoslovakia was already completed in 65 in the GDR. That is a new generation of young artists and also a young generation of audience and so on, who were hoping for a kind of a liberal and open development in cultures and also in the economy and so on, was frustrated by a crackdown on all these new tendencies in the end of 65 already. There was a famous or infamous plenary of the Central Committee, the 11th plenary. Everyone in East Germany knows what the 11th plenary of the Central Committee was. This 3-day long session forbade 12 films which had all been produced in 1965 because they were considered too dangerous. I will come back to this later. It took back some of the economic reforms, so there was this kind of liberalizing the economy was reduced, and it was there was a very harsh crackdown on youth culture, with police riot attacks on youth convening in the streets. Rock and roll music was banned, and young people having too long hairs were sent to labor camps, their hairs being cut, and all this kind of very repressive and intimidating procedures. For instance, one epitome of this change, of course, I mention him because later on this figure gets very important again, was the ban on the singer, songwriter and poet Wolf Biermann. He had been one of the most open and critical voices in these early years of the 60s. Always being on a, and that's typical for the atmosphere of the time, being on a sort of libertarian communist position. He was also popular in West Germany by his records. And then from now, within 1 week, he was forbidden to perform in public in the GDR. Interestingly enough, he was not put into jail or tried. So he remained a celebrity, so to speak, in a half position of underground and legality. It's important to introduce him. He has nothing to do with cinema otherwise, but he was a kind of a central figure in the cultural sphere, every intellectual, every artist, and so on. Yes?
Can you repeat the name?
Wolf Biermann. Oh, didn't I write it? There he is. Sorry. Wolf Biermann. I introduce him here not because he did films. He never did. He was, of course, well acquainted with all the filmmakers. He was kind of his apartment in downtown East Berlin was a meeting point for everyone who was a little bit critic or skeptical about what was going on in the official culture politics. And he is crucial for the later development of the GDR, and so far as in 1976 he was expatriated and was not allowed to return home from a trip to West Germany. And this then again triggered off a new wave of estrangement between artists and the regime in East Germany. This was really crucial. From then on, most East German artists were totally frustrated with their government. That's why Biermann is someone to keep in mind. not for film history because he never did films, he's a pure poet and songwriter. Just to complete our little trip through the time, in 6th of April 1968, we have, and this for the in the view of the regime is a point of completing the construction of socialism. The GDR parliament, which was of course a body totally controlled by the Communist Party, decreed a new socialist constitution of the GDR, in which socialism and the alliance with the Soviet Union is made a formal article of the constitution. And this also meant that from that time onwards, at the latest from that time onwards, the GDR leadership considered the GDR to be something of a new nation, in contrast to West Germany. During the 50s and the early 60s, the SED would always claim to represent the German nation in a better way than the other German state, and would kind of not acknowledge that the other German state is a true representative of Germany. This doctrine, so to speak, gave way to another idea, which meant now in the times of the Cold War and of the conflict between East and West, we have two nations developing. There's not one German nation anymore. We have two Germanys developing. There's a capitalist nation and there's a socialist nation. And they both happen to be German, but there is no German nation anymore. Of course, this was not believed by the Germans themselves. They meant that they still, on both sides of the wall, that they still have much in common in terms of history, in terms of culture, in terms of mutual understanding. But this was a kind of new doctrine now being put into place, although by the fact that this new constitution was drawn up and made official. Next step, which you all are quite familiar with, that East Germany, the SED, the communist leadership of the East Germany, supported and was part of the Warsaw Pact intervention against the Prague Spring in Czechoslovakia in August 68. It has to be noted, however, that as you might know from military history, that East German troops never actually were in Czechoslovakia. They were just standing behind the border in the woods in Saxony for eventually being mobilized to do so. But interestingly enough, the East German government never told the truth about this fact, but always pretended to have been with their troops in Czechoslovakia. This is a very weird little side aspect of this history. What is more important for the domestic dimension of this event, of course, is that inside East Germany there had been a lot of sympathizers with the Prague Spring and the reform movement in Czechoslovakia. In particular, among these intellectuals and, so to speak, younger people who had put a lot of hope in the liberal course after the wall had been constructed. So there was a sense of supporting or of sympathizing with this movement in Czechoslovakia. And when the intervention came and the Prague Spring was suppressed, there were some protests being expressed in East Germany as well, with a certain wave of repression, of course, against such people by the regime. But it was not a riot or a widespread thing. It was mainly among intellectuals and educated, much less among workers. And interestingly enough, it was very much about very young people. I found in police records much more conflicts with high school students, let's say in the age between 16 and 20 or 16 and 18. And young workers, apprentices in their apprenticeship, than with students of the university who were much more careful in voicing their dissatisfaction with this intervention in Czechoslovakia. But what one has to keep in mind that it nevertheless was a mark in the memory of a lot of people in East Germany, in particular, people who had to do with culture and intellectual life, that the 68 events were sort of trauma, so to speak. Now, to finish our short timeline excursion for this session, where I come to a close, so to speak, is the transition in power from Erich Honecker, General Secretary, becoming General Secretary in 1971, who replaces the already mentioned Walter Ulbricht, who had been the leader of the party more or less since, in East Germany, more or less since 45, had always been Moscow's first man, so to speak, in East Germany. It is interesting to know that this shift somehow, one could say it's a mere matter of change of generation. It was, of course, ordered and or approved of by Moscow. But already at this change, of course, in 1965, at the 11th, so-called 11th plenary, the rivalry between these two politicians played a major role. Although Ulbricht was a real core Stalinist from his upbringing in the party, he was always the one pushing for finding ways of reforming the economic system, of mobilizing society, of realizing a socialist society in his sense, as authoritarian as it might be. Whereas the younger Honecker represented, so to speak, the category of medium level and also mediocre functionaries who always feared that they would lose by too much dynamism. The people in the bureaucracies were not very happy with this reformist course, because if there would be too much reform, things could get out of control, they could lose their jobs or be pushed around. And so Honecker was always opposing Ulbricht's kind of riskful initiatives, and therefore the replacement of Ulbricht in 1971 also meant that now Erich Honecker would kind of come to a more smooth and calm course in domestic affairs, one which would not upsettle society too much, which not put on risk the status quo one has achieved so far. It's, so to speak, a difference which from a greater distance might be not as relevant, because they were both dictatorial and not very liberally minded communists, one has to keep in mind. But one can say that under Honecker and the remaining nearly two decades to come, not very much changed in the GDR, besides things going down. In a way, Honecker is then the figure which represents something like normalization in Czechoslovakia, that is a stagnant phase where all reform and dynamic spirit has evaporated, whereas the time of Ulbricht was still one in which the regime itself tried to change things if they would not go well. Okay, so much for the timeline, and now let's switch to, to more specific aspects of cultural politics, which also lead to the film history. In cultural politics and generally in the realm where which deal with fiction in a broader sense, with representation and of the real life in the GDR, a new doctrine, so to speak, had been installed, or a new development, a further development of the doctrine of what socialist realism should be, took place parallel to the developments I had shown you up to now. I already mentioned last time that socialist realism in its dogmatic and very sterile way was typical for late Stalinism, and that there was always a search for alternatives to this, be it named critical realism or the borrowings from in film from neorealism, and that it was well known to everyone that the social realism in the old Stalinist style was inflexible and could not be credited, was not living up to the times. This was also a view shared by party ideologists. There were new doctrines to be developed to bring art nearer to the population, to the audiences. And the way to do this was by bringing the artists nearer to the masses. And this was what then, in the context of the GDR, was introduced under the heading of the Bitterfelder Weg, the Bitterfeld Way. Now, you see here a conference, and Bitterfeld is an industrial town near Halle, famous for its huge chemistry plant, still there. And in 1959, a big conference of writers, cultural workers, and party functionaries was held there to discuss and to proclaim a new concept of how culture, including art and cinema, should be generated in the GDR. The artist was supposed to go to the working people, engage himself in production, become part of production collectives, become a member of a working brigade, for instance, and develop his work of art out of this experience, be it painting or writing poems or writing novels. But he should at the same time also contribute to the cultural education of the workers themselves. The utopia was not only to have better and more realistic artistic representation of the world of the real physical work, but also to make workers to write their own poems, their own novels, to paint a picture themselves, assisted and taught by artists working at the workplace. For instance, if you look at the slogan which was at the wall behind the stage, it says "Greif zur Feder, Kumpel," sorry, yeah, which means "Take the pen, pal or buddy." And the subtitle says "The socialist literature of the nation needs you." So all trust was put into mobilizing ordinary workers to do their own poems and having them assisted by artists, which in a kind of modest and self-restricted way should serve with their knowledge and their art the people. The separation of art and life, so to speak, was to be suspended. Also, the alienation between artists and the people, how it was put, should be overcome. It was a highly idealistic approach, but shared by the artists and in particular by young artists in a very enthusiastic way, because it also included that doing this would also mean that one has to confront the problems which are visible, which are there at the workplace, and which are problems of construction of socialism. So it was not a return to this kind of highly idealistic, stereotyped notion of socialist realism, which would always show the ideal version of a worker or of a working brigade, how life should be. But this focus on sharing and participating in the real life of production and of the working class also meant that one would be allowed to confront the problems of constructing socialism, which construction of socialism met at the grassroots level, so to speak. This created a new type of novels and reportage literature, which placed much emphasis also on subjective feelings and experience. And more often than not, the immersion of young writers in a veritable work collective proved to be full of conflicts and misunderstanding. You have the meeting of two very different social spheres and backgrounds. The young writer being often fully committed to the socialist cause, idealist, so to speak, but with quite less sense for the realities of working life, they were often confronted with so-called normal people, among whom many were totally indifferent to socialism or were openly against socialism and were only interested in the work collective as so far as it would secure their salary and their material welfare. arriving in this crude everyday life, far off from the blueprints of Marxism-Leninism, therefore marked this generation of literature. It was, as it was termed, an Ankunft im Alltag, an arrival in everyday life, as one of the famous novels of the time said it, arrival in everyday life by the novelist Brigitta Reimann. Did I put the name? Oh no, sorry. I will give you that later. There was also the technical term arrival literature, because it encapsulates this meeting between artists and the real world of production. In 1964, a second conference of a follow-up conference was held, which reiterated this approach of the Bitterfeld way, focusing more than before on the mission of the writers to support the development of a new socialist consciousness. But at the same time, it had meanwhile become evident that this concept of the Bitterfeld way would not work, so to speak, in the strict sense, that artists would not be prepared to spend a substantial part of their life in a brigade of a factory, and on the other side, that workers' interest in their products and workers' interest in producing themselves valuable poetry or whatsoever was very limited. So there was a kind of sobering down, of disenchantment. But at the same time, there was a much more open spirit for artistic experiment and also liberation of, so to speak, formal restraints, aesthetic restraints imposed on literary production. One can say that what had taken to some extent the Kafka conference in Czechoslovakia in 63 as a way of opening up things took place also in 64 in this second Bitterfelder conference. This development in the course of culture politics is important to keep in mind with regard to today's film, The Divided Heaven by Konrad Wolf, because it was produced exactly in this year, 63-64, and the author of the novel from which this film was adapted, Christa Wolf, who is no relation with Konrad Wolf, it's a coincidence of family names, because this author, a very young author at the time, shared this experience, although from a more critical standpoint. He shared the experience of what happens if the young artist meets real society, so to speak. This novel, The Divided Heaven, thematizes the relation between the young generation of educated who had grown up in the GDR and the working class, and it discusses the necessity to take sides in the conflict between the two world systems, as it was perceived at the time, that is, to take sides for socialism and the working class and against the bourgeoisie. How this is put into a plot, into a story, you will see later when we will have the screening. So the adoption of this concept was more or less then later, after the 11th plenum, given up in the strict sense that you would stop sending artists compulsorily into workshops and brigades as a matter of course. However, some of it remained as an experiment. Some of it remained as an experience how problematic it is if art, so to speak, meets grassroots reality. And this continued to occupy a lot of artists and film writers and poets, painters in the GDR. It was always typical for the GDR art, in whatever category one is looking, that the concern for the realities of working life and addressing them remained a central feature of art production. Now, let's turn to the next point, which is focus on cinematic production in this time period, 58 to 71. It was about, of course, overcoming the crisis of the early 50s I had told about in the last time. And we can see now an increasing consolidation, one can say, and also diversification of cinema production if you look at the production of feature films alone. As I had told you, in the crisis year of the early 50s, per year production of feature films had fallen to something like 3 or 4 or 5, which is not very much for a population of 16, 17 million. That meant that one on the long run would be totally dependent on importation. And now production increased to an average of 15 to 20, 25 per year. First of all, it had to be stressed that the DEFA and its production units from 56 onwards gained some considerable degree of, so to speak, practical independence. Of course, the DEFA was always subordinated and controlled by the so-called main department of the Ministry of Culture, a own main department just for controlling film. And in any case, high-ranking party officials always had a last word on any film to be shown in public. But this could rather take on the forms of a post-production censorship than following up every stage of the filmmaking process itself, which had led to this endless protraction in realizing a film, wasting a lot of energy and resources, and making films more or less unseeable in the end because there had been so much people intervening and imposing cuts or imposing post-shooting and so on that the original film of a original idea of a film had been completely lost. In the production process of filmmaking, now the filmmakers of the DEFA gained much more autonomy. They were organized in so-called künstlerische Arbeitsgemeinschaften, artistic work communities, in which the different functions within film productions, beginning from script writing, the dramatic advisor, cameraman, costume designer, up to the sound engineer, the director, and the producers were united in one large collective, which were a subunit, so to speak, within the DEFA. And within the planning and dispositions of the DEFA as the umbrella enterprise, these collectives, these artistic collectives, could move relatively freely in developing their new projects. In contrast to film industry in the capitalist societies, these artists had a safe and a secure position. They had fixed salaries and did not have to face the risk of economic failure when their products were not received well by the audience. So this was a relatively comfortable and one can say safe position. Another important change which then occurred in 61 was of course that with the closure of the wall, or the erection of the Berlin Wall, the closure of the border, all these commuters which had still existed to some extent at DEFA, living in West Berlin and working at the DEFA in Potsdam or Babelsberg near West Berlin, now were closed out. They had to remain in the West. There were only very, very few exceptional high-ranking artists, some actors who could go on doing sometimes some jobs for the DEFA, but all the technicians which had been in place, they had to opt, they had to make their choice, and either to settle and down in the GDR or to try to find work in the Western film industry. So also this separation had now been completed. Among the films with the we can now see in the years after 1958 and throughout the 60s an increasing degree of differentiation in the film production by genres and themes. Among the films dealing with the present of the times, there were mainly the following tendency to see: the GDR itself as a theme, inner conditions of the GDR, such as already in Berlin Ecke Schönhauser, but there were then also not just film on Berlin and the urban life, there were also films on collectivization and everyday life in GDR enterprises. including more and more comedies, kind of harmful, entertaining films, relatively short ones, which were very light and only served to entertain people, but which nevertheless took place within their own environment, which was something which the SAD officers in the earlier times of the 50s had a lot of problems with, because they would this consider as a sort of banalization of the socialist society which would emerge. They were even now coming more and more often crime stories being set in the GDR, also something which the GDR leadership up to that time was very insecure about, because this was thematized that crime was still in place in the GDR. And now you would also find a more relaxed attitude to such subjects and also to the genres going along with it. Then regarding films dealing with the present, there were also some production on West Germany, so to speak, the GDR trying to teach the East Germans, the East German citizens, how it was like to be or to live in West Germany and what kind of dangers this entailed. This is a film, the Spielbank Affair, the casino affair, about decadence and corruption in West Germany, tied up, of course, with the evil affairs of former Nazis. This was always kind of same plot. Thereby, following this interpretation, Germany was some kind of a crypto-fascist state dominated by old Nazis and their network, covered by a glistering surface of wealth and splendor, which was, of course, only accessible to elite of the happy few. Such films never went very well with the East German audience, because the East Germans would know from television and, of course, from relatives and from contacts they had to East German, to West Germany, that things looked different. Regarding films on the recent past, the spectrum of themes was also enlarged in these years. It was not only about heroization of communist resistance and the glorious role of the Soviet Union in fighting Nazism. As an example, last time I had mentioned this huge production on Ernst Thälmann, on the communist leader who had been killed by the Nazis in the concentration camps. Now also other aspects of the Nazi past and of the Second World War were treated more frequently and in a much more differentiated way. I will come back to this in the context of the two filmmakers, Konrad Wolf and Frank Beyer. Frank Beyer is the filmmaker I will talk about in 2 weeks. And then, of course, there was something which always found its audience in all times, that is adaptions from classics from the literary canon, be it Goethe, be it Lessing, the big German poets, so to speak, or also something which went quite well, doing co-production with French cinema makers. There was a little episode of 3 years where every year a big French cinema star would produce together with DEFA in Babelsberg, Jean Gabin and Fanfan La Tulipe, Gérard Philippe and Yves Montand. They would come and shoot in Babelsberg, and they would. This would follow very much the principle to adapt very well-established classical literature, such as Zola, Les Misérables, and Balzac novels, or things like that. And they were also quite popular with the GDR audience, because the GDR audience, as well as other audience in East Europe, liked very much these French big stars. Gérard Philippe and Yves Montand, Simon Signoret, Jean Gamin, they were very, very popular. They were considered as, and they were also presented by the regime, as the good stars in international cinema, in contrast to all the bad American stars in international cinema. And this is a sub-feature of international film history one could elaborate a lot more about, but in the end it was only a little episode. Then you would have the attempt to go into science fiction, The Silent Star, 1960, the most expensive production that DEFA ever did, which is an adaptation of Stanisław Lem, the Polish author and early or pioneer of science fiction novels. And you would have a sequel of these films in the years to come, which were very popular and also were exportable. That's interesting. Not all DEFA films were exportable, but this one was. And you would have what I already mentioned, Gojko Mitic, the Sons of the Big Mother Bear. This one is from 66, and this was also, so to speak, the beginning of a longer series of so-called Indian films, Indiana filme, which gained some popularity and also proved to be exportable. One has to keep in mind that this opening up for genres in general as a formula to attract the audience participation, to be popular with the audience, was not a triviality by in itself. Originally, these genres were considered skeptically by the culture politicians of the GDR because they were somehow Western, and one had the idea that giving into this would kind of make concessions to the retarded and unenlightened tastes of the public, of the GDR public in general. So developing such genres was, in the first place, an attempt to show to the GDR audiences that one could do oneself such films in a proper and understanding way. In the end, one can say that throughout the rest remaining decades of the GDR film history, such genres which were typical for the international cinema trends, so to speak, took firm roots in the GDR itself. Nevertheless, one has to keep in mind that the audience of GDR cinema, that the moviegoers in the GDR, of course, always knew that they were some sort of derivative, that they were not, had not been, so to speak, invented in the GDR, that there were models for this, which came, as most models for very popular filmmaking, from the West, and particularly from the other side of the Atlantic, from Hollywood. And this is important to keep in mind, because this meant at the same time that also for the GDR audience in general, the yardstick, the measure for what really good cinema meant, where it came from, where what was to be considered, so to speak, the real thing to be enthusiastic for, was always basically Hollywood cinema. And in a way, the population and the audience considered such productions as the Indiana filme, so to speak, the GDR way of doing a Western, as a sort of concession to the audience, to the fact that this is the way one can do it even within socialism, without undermining or putting into question that the yardstick for this comes from the West. What this means in the same time is, of course, that any talk about the model function of the Soviet Union in cultural matters or so on didn't have any meaning for most of the people, because their media orientation in aesthetics, in so to speak, their world look, was always dominated by Western standards, and this was firmly instituted in a paradoxical way, even reconfirmed by the concession the cultural politics made to these tastes and expectation of the audience when producing, for instance, such films. Same can be said, this is a classic in this respect for this spy thriller by Jana Schweizi from 1963, a sadly very aesthetically very interesting film on a spy, GDR spy of the Stasi, who is kind of stealing a how you call that, a bank safe with a lot of documents in it, and brings it into the GDR. And based on a more or less authentic case which had taken place in the late 50s. This was a huge success with the audience, but it was fully in style of what one would expect of a cool spy thriller also in by a Western movie production. And so it kind of reaffirmed the dominance of these styles in the GDR, with the GDR audience. Now, before we move on to our today's film, because I guess we will see it right afterwards again, let's now have a look at the cinematic fallout of the construction of the Berlin Wall. In the first 2 years after the construction of the wall, as I said, there was a kind of a campaigning of the party state to legitimize this act of violence. It was an act of violence. It was curtailing the mobility of all GDR citizens who up to that time could freely, relatively freely, move back and forth between East and West, at least in Berlin. And a lot of East Germans were doing this because the GDR was not that big that you could not go for one day to Berlin and visit your relatives, meet your relatives in the western part of the city and so on. So a lot of people had this practice. Now this was suddenly shut down, and people had to cope with a sense of isolation and betrayal also. And the regime, by a propaganda way, tried to cope and to address this feeling by producing several films of a rather bad quality, therefore I do not mention them in detail, justifying this. So you would see a certain scheme evolve, and this is important to understand the film we will go to see today. You have a certain scheme evolving which always puts it that way that, and this is of course, if you have something dividing up and the polarity between two characters, the way which offers itself is doing it as a drama of love, of a man and a woman, girl and a boy having a love affair and being divided up between East and West, either the man being in the West and the boy, girl being in the East, or the other way around. And if things turn out for the good, then the one from the West takes the good decision and opts for the East, leaves, for instance, his decadent bourgeois partner in order to join the new partnership in the East, and then things go well on the way to socialism. This was a plot which was rehearsed through several times in the different comedies and tragedies, or more kind of serious melodramas, which were aiming at convincing the GDR audience about the necessity and the historic unavoidability of this act of building the wall, and of the act that Germany, for better or worse, now had to be divided in order that socialism can be constructed in the better half of it, from this perspective of the SED. This plot, this idea that one can represent the German division via a, so to speak, gendered gendered division of gender polarity and its inner dynamic, was also subscribing or at the base of the novel which we will see as next. And now I have to switch the my data base in order to come to the other. Sorry for a moment. Uh, Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, see here. The Divided Heaven. Let me give a short introduction into The Divided Heaven. That's my script. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I know it by heart. Divided. This is Christa Wolf, the author I've already talked about. Not being anyway related to the director Konrad Wolf. This is just a pure coincidence of names. Christa Wolf was born in 1929, and she's still alive. She is, one can say, the most famous East German writer. There is quite a number of very let's say, famous East German writers, but one can consider her to being one of the most representative. The novel which Konrad Wolf then adapted, The Divided Heaven, Der geteilte Himmel, was her first book, and it was a success right away in 1963. It's about a woman going into who has a relationship with a chemist, and who's working in a big plant. So it's not exactly in Bitterfeld, but it's the region there. It's in the town of Halle, which is nearby Bitterfeld. So the backdrop is the chemistry industry, where her boyfriend is working as an engineer. He is of a bourgeois family background and always very critical about the regime. She comes from a lower class background, from the countryside, and has made her way up by education, and is visiting a teacher seminar, and at the same time working in a brigade in a train wagon factory. And the experiences she makes there, in the end, convince her to decide herself against her boyfriend, who, after some frustration with his superiors, because they do not recognize his inventions, his genius as a chemist, flees into the West. The story is set in a way that it is clear from the setting that this is still taking place before the wall was constructed, but the film was produced after the wall has been constructed. So everyone, it is evident to everyone that this is something on the way things could be before the wall was constructed. But nevertheless, she, this Rita, the main character, the protagonist, decides against following her boyfriend, who flees into the West and remains in the East. So it's a justification of this decision in the light of the more recent developments. Just some words on Konrad Wolf. Konrad Wolf is a very peculiar and interesting character of the GDR film history. One can say, for many people who are experts of GDR film history, consider him as being the most important director, and one can also say one of the most important artists in general of the GDR history. He was born in 1925 in a Jewish bourgeois family in southern Germany, in Hechingen. But a family whose father, Friedrich Wolf, was already engaged with communism, who was a member of a communist party during the 20s, and who worked on the one side as a doctor, and as a politically engaged doctor, and as a writer, as a playwright. So Friedrich Wolf was a celebrity already in the 20s, as a playwright, as a public figure, so to speak. And Konrad Wolf and his brother Markus Wolf, together with Friedrich Wolf, which is the father on the right side, went into exile into the Soviet Union in 1933, because they had to leave as communists after the Nazis took power. And there, Konrad Wolf, which is the younger one of these two brothers, then was socialized and raised, so to speak, in a Russian-German way. He learned Russian as like his mother tongue, and he returned to Germany as an officer of the Red Army in 1945. He joined the army with the age of 17, and so did all the campaign until May 1945. He was part of the first troops to conquer Berlin in April 1925, and this is relevant because one of his most famous films is telling the episodes and the experiences he had as a young officer in these weeks from the end of April until the middle of May, when Berlin was taken by the Red Army. After this, Konrad Wolf then worked for 1 or 2 years in the cultural section of the Soviet Military Occupation Administration in East Germany, but then went back to Moscow to, in a regular fashion, so to speak, as a Soviet citizen, which he was at that time, and which he remained all through his life, besides being an East German citizen, to do take his film studies in Moscow at the Film Academy. And after he had finished this, he returned to East Germany in the middle of the 50s, in 54, and started his career as a film director. There are several of his films which are more or less well known. He also, this for instance is one, the Sonnensucher, the Sun Seekers, is on the Soviet-East German relationship in the 50s, which was not very, not always very easy. It's set in the Wismut region in the southern part of East Germany, where there were big mining sites for uranium, where the Soviets would run big companies for the extraction of uranium, and where, so to speak, Soviet entrepreneurs and a German working class were confronting each other in the early 50s. And so this is a very dramatic story set in that context, and the issues which were dealt with, which were dealing with this, were so problematic and touchy that the Soviets would not allow the film to be shown in 59 when it was done. So it was only in 72 that this film then could go public. This is one of his famous films, Sterne, as you see from the star on the woman's scarf. You might see this is from a story about the Holocaust in Bulgaria. It's a Bulgarian GDR co-production, a love story between a German soldier and a Jewish woman from Macedonia. And it is one of the very, very few films of DEFA production which directly addresses the Holocaust, not just Nazi persecution, but the deportation to the death camps. A film which won a prize at the Cannes Film Festival in 59. And one can say safely also in general for German film history, one of the very, very early films addressing the theme of the deportation and of the Holocaust. Konrad Wolf dealt with several themes of the Nazi past. That is, interestingly enough, I will give you the list tomorrow, the more conclusive one, because I don't find the list right now. This is taken from his film Professor Mumlock. There he adapted a piece of his play of his father, a drama of a Jewish doctor confronting the seizure of power of the Nazis in Germany in 1933. And this is the film I already gave you a hint to. Ich war 19, I was 19, is retelling this experience which he had as a young officer when entering or conquering, taking Berlin in 1944 and 1945. It's a very, so to speak, subjective way to tell the stories, to tell how the war ended from the perspective of a homecoming 19-year-old who, of course, as a soldier and as nearly a kid, so to speak, sees war and the confrontation with his own German fellow men in a way which is totally different, let's say, from a more grown-up and adult Russian, so to speak, officer. This is one of his last production from 1982, Solo Sunny. Solo Sunny, and this also shows another aspect of Konrad Wolf's oeuvre, which reminds us also of the film we are going to see today. You can say he has two. In a large way, two specialties. He can focus on these war-related and Nazi time-related characters, which is very much approaches very often from his own personal background and from the resources, so to speak, out of the experience of anti-fascists, of Nazi opponents being in exile or going through these experiences of persecution and of also of resistance. Whereas a second theme which she deals with very often is to show how socialist society evolves from the perspective of women who have to confront complicated situations, be it of discrimination or of lacking acknowledgement, and finding their ways of making their way in socialist society. Solo Sunny is then a story about an East Berlin rock singer who wants to make her own career as a band leader and has to meet all kinds of confrontations and hindrances put upon by party functionaries and in particular all by her male colleagues. Interestingly enough, this film was also one of the DEFA productions which then were quite popular in West Germany when it came out in the early 80s. It was, you could say, a music movie on the rock business, on the rock and roll art community, which went also very well with a West German audience, not just exclusively for East Germany. Okay, this is it so far for today. Tomorrow we will then speak more at length about this film we will go to see today. I just gave you a framing both regarding the novel on which it is based and the director who did it. One has to keep in mind, just to complete on Konrad Wolf, he always had some kind of trouble with the socialist authorities. His films were too critical, they were aesthetically too innovative, they were kind of not conventional cinema. Nevertheless, he remained loyal to the system until the very end. He was both recognized by his colleagues. He had a huge, so to speak, personal prestige by his own upbringing in this, if you want, communist ancestry, by his anti-fascist experience, having fought the Nazis, so to speak, as a soldier. And at the same time, he was also sort of untouchable for the regime take him, so to speak, to discipline him or to put repression against a figure such as him would have meant to run into troubles, for instance, also with Soviet good friends Konrad Wolf always had, because he had been raised in Moscow. And so he could use this strong situation very often also to help other ones. Nevertheless, he remained loyal. He never kind of openly spoke out against the regime. Interestingly enough, this kind of very complicated situation also can be seen and is dealt with in some of his films where the relation between the artist and power is an object of debate. Indirectly, you find it in the film which we'll see now, but more openly, you will find it also, for instance, in films such as on the Spanish painter Goya, which he made a biopic, so to speak, of about, where he also discusses the question of the relation between the artist and political power, to what extent the artist can emancipate himself from the positions and the expectations of the one who pays him, basically, which is of course always a problem for any film production, that there are people who commission this and who might want to have an influence, be it a political one or an economic one or whatsoever, on what the film artist does. So this is also a theme Konrad Wolf constantly deals with and tries to reflect upon. And I will conclude here, and I think we have a little intermission and then go on. Just another thing, last word. Now we are going to see the film. Try to take down notes or keep in memory questions that we might tomorrow morning start with a sort of a discussion or exchange on the film, what you like about it, what it meant to you, whether it was very far from your expectation, or whether it reminds you of other films. I would also like to know whether this reminds you of films which were done in Czechoslovakia or in other parts of the world which you might happen to know. I think films should always be something to be discussed about, not just being watched. Thank you.